All right, well, why don't I get started? Some of you might be a little surprised and scratching your heads at the word unequivocal, and that's used a lot in this area, and the reason for that is it's pulled directly out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change summary report in 2007. So they made this statement saying the science is unequivocal on climate change. So a lot of people pick up on that, and yet the basic background on it is very firmly established, and yet there are certain things that remain. So we'll be talking a little bit about the uncertainty that's involved in this science. And Chris read that word monolithic, and I wondered why I put that in there. That's definitely not in the in the IPCC report.
Well, I was hoping I was reading or saying it right in some other.
Yeah, that means it's not monolithic. It's not all the same across any type of question about climate change that you were to ask. So some questions are a little bit open, and actually, I just added this. This is a little bit of an aside. The term chaos came up in Julia's session yesterday, and I kind of mentioned that there's a scientific definition of the word chaos, and it actually has a lot to do with the definition of climate as opposed to weather. So the scientific definition of chaos is that you have a system that can have several different states, several possibilities of what's happening. So in the weather system, that'll be, you know, is it raining today? What's our temperature today? There are a range of possibilities that can be happening. And the other part of the you can't predict for more than a little while which of those possibilities is going to actually happen. So that's sort of more the definition of weather, that it keeps changing all the time and there's an inherent unpredictability to it as you get further out in time. The other part of the definition of chaos is that the range of possibilities has limits, and it occupies only a certain range of conditions, and that range is really the definition of climate. Actually, as sort of another aside, you might not quite realize that, not think of it this way, but one of the major modes of climate variability is simply the annual cycle. And we really know the cause that lies behind that. We've observed it many times. And we kind of know what happens with the annual cycle. It's colder in the winter than during the summer, and some other phenomena happen with that. There's also the diurnal cycle, day versus night. But those are conditions that kind of govern the envelope that is climate, the range of possible states of the weather. So that was kind of an aside, and this is the outline of what I'm going to present. The big picture is really the things that we are quite certain about with climate change. And then the next question is, how is uncertainty different from ignorance? And I hope to dispose of that pretty quickly. What are causes of uncertainty? And as an example, this is very closely related to my research, projected Great Lakes levels under climate change scenarios. And then the last one I kind of tacked on here, it kind of relates to my next presentation, but it's also an area that has uncertainty as a key component of it. Geoengineering is, I'll describe it more later on, but it's ways of deliberately altering the Earth in order to cancel out the effects of CO2. And we'll see later on that you can cancel out some effects, but not all of them. Okay, so I got these out of order. Okay, the big picture. Science is unequivocal on many points. Temperature of the Earth is increasing. This is primarily caused by CO2 emissions by humans, and this will continue into the future. You've heard.
So before you go on,
yeah.
I just had a question. So I was talking to another engineer a few years back, and we're talking about global warming, and his comment was, well, the cause of global warming is the sun, not anyway. Mm-hmm. So my question is I know we monitor the sun.
Yeah.
Has the temperature of the sun changed?
It oscillates back and forth a little bit.
We have the cycles of the sun as well, right?
And people wonder a little bit if the sort of stalling of this progression of warming that I mentioned the other day, where it really hasn't warmed since 1998, that might be due to the sun. One of the real reasons why that we point at that it isn't caused by the sun is that the warming is occurring close to the surface and through the troposphere, which really extends up to about 6 miles above the surface. But if you go above that, in the range of 8 to 15 miles above the surface, it's cooling. Yeah, if you really want to talk about this offline, I can tell you why it's cooling there. And that is the signature of greenhouse gases. If it were coming from the sun, it would be warming up throughout the entire depth of the atmosphere.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I need to back up by one slide. Some of the things that have greater uncertainty are those that are more local. We're predicting things on the broad global scale. Have more confidence in those, but the smaller area that you get into, the greater the uncertainty. Things that are dependent on time variability. One of the things that seems to be a pretty good bet, but does have a higher degree of uncertainty than some of the time mean things, is the storminess. Projection that we're going to have stronger storms, and there's a record that kind of backs that up, but it has greater uncertainty than some of the time mean projections. So when I say more links in the chain of causality, the Great Lakes levels is one of the examples. You start out with greenhouse gases, and then you have a bunch of things happening. You have air temperatures. You have the amount of energy that's being transferred from both the sun and the atmosphere into the surface, and you have evaporation, you have precipitation. There are all these factors, and each of those has uncertainty built into it. And then you have to put those all together, and you add some more uncertainty. So there are issues with that. So how is uncertainty different from ignorance? Uncertainty has limits, sometimes really strictly quantifiable, sometimes qualitative, expert opinion type of judgments on them, but ignorance knows no bounds.
Now there's a slogan to live by.
All right, so an example of what people think of when they hear the word uncertainty is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And he stated this as an aside, Heisenberg is kind of the main quantum physicist who stayed in the Third Reich. So he didn't really like Hitler, but but he stayed there and worked for his government. But in any case, this equation says delta x is uncertainty in position, and delta q is uncertainty of momentum. And if you multiply those together, that should equal approximately Planck's constant. So Heisenberg said that there's this fundamental uncertainty in knowing the position and speed of things, and it really only comes into play when it's small objects in a small space. And the main application of this has been electrons around an atom. So you really have to get down to small things for that to make sense. But the analogy is that if you look at an atom, you know whether the electrons are there. You can see if the electron just completely exits from the atom. So you know it's there somewhere, but you can't say, you know, it's exactly at this point in the orbit of the nucleus of the atom. So in terms of climate change, we know that warming is there on the global average between 2 and 6 degrees Celsius, or 3.6 to 12.6 Fahrenheit. It's not zero, and it's not cooling. You know, slim chance that it's higher than that either. Other impacts, the question becomes more fuzzy. If you want to figure out what the flow and railroad creep might be in the long term, or number of cardinals in your backyard, I just pulled these examples out of thin air. They have levels of uncertainty that most likely are greater, but have to be taken on a case-by-case basis.
Friends?
Yeah.
The 2 and 6 degrees Celsius of warming, over what period of time is that? Over.
Yeah, that's per doubling of CO2. So if you, double the concentration of CO2. Usually we think of that as being roughly in the area of 70 years. So if you take the beginning of a 70-year period, then the end of it, roughly doubling of CO2. And there are different scenarios that we consider to be possibilities in terms of the rate of that changing. And that leads into the first point here. One of the sources of uncertainty is future greenhouse gas concentration, linked in with that is emission by humans. So there's a distinction between those two, but they're closely related. If you're using a climate model, there can be problems in the model processes that should lead to the big picture being accurate, but problems with details. And some of those problems include location. Is it going to be warming up more in the valleys as opposed to on the mountains? We have real difficulty getting down to that level of detail. Questions of variability with time. I already said there's the issue of, are we really experiencing more intense thunderstorms? and that sort of thing. The projections deal more with long-term phenomena. And then the impacts, the subsequent steps. So I already gave you examples of how much water might flow in in Railroad Creek. Other possible examples, crop yields, evaporation, glacial dynamics. And actually, I'm going to be referring specifically to that in a later slide. Ecosystem responses, you know, what do various plants and animals do in response to this? And human responses. So health and economic activity, that sort of thing. So these are some of my results that tell you something about Great Lakes levels. And now I need to remind myself. Actually, I said that for Great Lakes levels, in addition, okay, this was sort of informal conversation before several of you showed up. But in addition to these sort of global arguments that break off at 1998 that I was talking about the other day, there's kind of a break point in Great Lakes levels at 1998. And actually, what this is graphing is the time after 1998. The left-hand side here is 1999. So what we see here in blue is the actual recorded lake levels, and everything to the left of to the right of 2013 is projections. So the top is Lake Superior, middle is Lakes Michigan and Huron, and the bottom is Lake Erie. And we have a few sources of projections. I mentioned the book by Catherine Hayhoe, and she wrote the book along with her husband, who's a minister, and that was appealing to evangelical Christians. But this is actually some of her research, and she, along with one of my colleagues, projected drops in lake levels. So actually the orange is the numbers that she came up with that are averaged over different time periods, and this is showing a drop in lake levels with time. Then the green rectangles are due to Angel and Kunkel, and those are showing ranges of possible lake level drops and rises based on various climate model inputs. And then I actually published a paper in 2011 that drew up serious questions about the methodology that had been used in these other papers, and showed that I project different lake levels, and actually they do overlap pretty well with this Angel and Kunkel, but generally are a little bit higher lake levels than what they projected. So basically what I was showing is that these previous pieces of research had exaggerated the effect of climate change on the lake levels of the Great Lakes. And this is a schematic diagram of some of the assumptions that went into the older pieces of research. So out of the hands of those researchers was a projection of how greenhouse gases would affect precipitation and air temperature. And then they assumed that there was a direct line from just these two variables to evaporation. And the amount of water available to the Great Lakes is basically precipitation minus evaporation. The difference between those two will end up going into the Great Lakes and gradually flowing out, and it has a strong influence on the lake level. So this was something that sort of seemed obvious to people and was broadly accepted that this was the mechanism that was used. And even more specifically, there was a particular algorithm that used this concept that ended up being used over and over again by Hayho et al., Angel and Kunkel, and earlier some other people. They kept using it over and over again and inputting different climate models, results for air temperature and precip, and came up with basically the same results over and over again, and sort of claimed that these were independent results because they had used different air temperature and precipitation. So, previously assumed chain of causality there. This is what I call more accurate chain of causality. In other presentations, I've put the label on this of the real world simplified. Okay, so what's going on here is this is kind of a chart of several different interactions between, this is the surface down here, these are variables describing the state of the atmosphere. These are things that are exchanged between them, different kinds of energy and friction for wind and latent heat of evaporation. And then up at the top are exchanges between the whole Earth system and outer space. So the ones in yellow, downward solar radiation is the amount of sunlight we're getting in, the amount of energy that that is coming to the surface and the atmosphere from the sun. Or you can also think of it as heat rather than energy. So that's actually the driver of the seasonal cycle. But then the downward long wave radiation is what's involved in climate change. It's increased with the amount of greenhouse gases that are there. So the way that this model was formulated ended up really being calibrated so that it matched up with the seasonal cycle, which is driven by the downward solar radiation, the time of year. And let's see, where is air temperature here? Okay, so here's air temperature. There's a signal in the seasonal cycle for air temperature. And then, so it's, you know, I can't even trace the whole pathway. There's part of it is directly from downward solar, and then there are some other pathways that are going to feed back into here. Then downward long wave radiation is going to drive that air temperature through a more circuitous pathway. Things aren't all going to act the same, especially when what you're looking at is right here, and there's no direct line between some of these other items. So, you know, it's really more complicated than what people had shown before, more uncertain than what they had shown. So, a few examples aside from this, and, well, actually, let's talk about sort of the two sides of uncertainty. Those who don't want to take action on climate change will say, well, it's uncertain, and the more uncertainty there is, the less action we should take. On the other side is you know, it is uncertain, and that uncertainty could come to bite us. So it could be really bad. And these are some examples of things that have been observed in recent years that really weren't expected, and they were part of the uncertainty, and we still don't entirely understand all of these things, but they look worse than was expected as of 1 or 2 decades ago. So the first is ocean acidification, which really isn't due to climate change per se, but is associated with higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's just transferring that carbon dioxide right into the ocean, turns into carbonic acid when it combines with water, and that has harmful effects, particularly on corals and also shellfish, I believe. So that's a negative effect that was kind of suddenly realized in the mid-1990s, and people did kind of go like that and say, well, why didn't I think of that? It's already happening. But it came as a surprise to people. And disappearance of ice in the Arctic Ocean was anticipated, but not as fast as we've actually observed it. The area of ice in the Arctic Ocean during the minimum, which usually occurs in September, has decreased drastically. The 2007, I believe, is the minimum so far, and that was actually due to a combination of melting due to climate change and sort of a natural variability type of thing, and in this case it was actually a wind blowing the ice toward Greenland, and there was less of it there in that particular year. And then rapidity of glacier loss. Has anyone heard of the movie called Chasing Ice? Yeah, that's a fairly recent movie, and it's a lot of it is sort of biographical about the filmmakers who were making this. And what they were doing was time-lapse photography, looking at particular glaciers and showing them diminish with time. But anyway, glacier loss, especially in Greenland, is surprising, and a large part of the reason for it being surprising is that we really didn't have a theory that applied across all glaciers for how fast they're going to flow. And these Greenland glaciers just started flowing faster and faster and going into the ocean. It really hasn't happened in Antarctica yet, but we don't know what might happen in the future. All right, so now this one is kind of an aside, and I'm calling it a look ahead to the next presentation. And the next one is going to be about mitigation, and it's things that are going to prevent climate change. But I'm talking about geoengineering now, partially to allow more time for the next one, and partially because it's a very uncertain approach to doing this. Actually, if you decrease the amount of greenhouse gases being emitted into the atmosphere, that decreases the uncertainty. It makes everything more like status quo. Geoengineering, on the other hand, has a much greater degree of uncertainty. So the main kind of thing that people are talking about to have a techno fix to climate change is stratospheric dust. Just purposely put it way up there in the atmosphere where it's not going to settle out very quickly, and it'll reflect sunlight back out of the Earth's system. a few people say orbiting mirrors, so like some kind of mirror of a given size that will sit between the Earth and the Sun and reflect back some of the sunlight. Both of those options allow less sunlight to reach the Earth. So on the positive side, this seems relatively easy compared to some of the other options. It might prevent tipping points, which some of the particular ones that come to mind are just complete disappearance of Greenland ice or Antarctic ice in a more extreme scenario. And it should be able to restore global mean air temperature. And I'm emphasizing global mean because it's not going to restore the historical temperature at all places in the same way. So con, it will likely alter local characteristics. So one of the things that's a characteristic of warming by greenhouse gases is it's going to warm near the poles by a greater amount than near the equator, and that's already observed. The greatest amount of warming to date has happened in Alaska and Siberia. And this kind of geoengineering, by shutting out some of the sunlight, is actually going to be more effective at cooling the equator rather than the poles. So even though the global average change in temperature due to the combination of greenhouse gases and geoengineering might give you a zero result, both of them act to reduce the difference in temperature between the equator and the pole. Time characteristics, precipitation in particular, precipitation and evaporation will expect to both be reduced using geoengineering. Ocean acidity, that problem remains. You haven't removed the CO2 from the atmosphere, so the oceans are picking it up. Diurnal temperature cycle, day versus night, both, it's similar to the gradient in temperature between equator and pole. Both greenhouse gases and geoengineering for reflection of sunlight, both of those act to reduce the difference in temperature between day and night. And milky sky, it'll look hazy. You won't have quite such a nice blue sky. And then the other thing, and this sort of foreshadows tomorrow's presentation as well, is that it requires global coordination. You need to know how much of this dust to put out there, and it's likely that you can't determine that well the exact locations where it's going to be. There'll be winners and losers out of this, and who gets to decide? So part of what we'll be talking about tomorrow is global decision-making that needs to be done surrounding climate change, and the geoengineering question is sort of one facet of that. So with that, I think I'll open for discussion. Yeah?
My understanding is that there are some particles in the Alaskan tundra and northern Canada that are being released because the tundra is thawing, and that they are causing rain to fall earlier over North America rather than the Saharan Desert. Is that true?
Boy, I don't know about that. When you first started describing that, I was thinking of methane emissions from permafrost.
I think it's different though.
That's a different question from what you're describing. I don't know what to tell you about that. There's been a lot of discussion of the effects of dust from the Sahara Desert on climate in several places. So yeah, there can be other processes that seem sort of natural, like the Sahara dust being suspended, that are happening at the same time as greenhouse gas increases, and it can be tough to untangle those things.
So putting, or with dust in the stratosphere and kind of averaging out the global temperature between the equator and the poles just seems kind of like a bad idea, because our weather is so dependent on those differences.
Yeah, well, one of the advantages is it's easier to revoke than putting CO2 in the atmosphere.
How do you get rid of the dust once you put it up there?
It settles out eventually. It's not instantaneous, but. So
it's more of a, we throw a bunch of dust out there, we see what happens. If it produces a positive change, we continue to throw dust out there
right.
to maintain it.
Right.
Or you get the perfect balance, and then three volcanoes erupt, and now
that's what I call messing with Mother Nature.
Has geoengineering ever worked anywhere? And if so, an example?
Yeah, well, Chris brought up the volcano, and that's not human design, but it's an analogous situation. Mount Pinatubo erupted in 1993, I think, and caused some cooling worldwide. And actually, we specify stratospheric dust, and one of the things that was really unusual about Mount Pinatubo was it erupted so high that the dust got up in the stratosphere, and it was able to stay there for 2 years is the usual time period that people give for that effect.
So how high is the stratosphere?
Stratosphere is above about 7-8 miles.
So both commercial air?
Yeah, the lower boundary of it is actually higher up in the tropics than higher latitudes. Chris?
So it seemed to be, this is a question on the debate about climate change. It seemed like the debate was, is climate change or the Earth warming up or not? And lately it seems to have shifted, and I don't know, maybe this might just my perception is that people are now acknowledging that it is warming, but whether it's man-made or not, is that the debate? Or
Within the scientific community, that's not the debate.
Well, no, I know that's not. I'm talking what you hear in the probably the political debate about it.
Yeah, well, in the political realm, sort of the doubters just keep retreating a little bit more, and to my mind, take more and more desperate measures.
Ignorance has no bounds.
Right.
Are there other methods of geoengineering?
I don't know. People have talked about trying to put white blankets over huge areas. And
I've heard just trying to paint all the buildings white. That's the one I've heard.
Yeah, so, I mean, that sort of thing... painting buildings white might do something for urban heat islands and that sort of thing, but yeah, not much on a global scale.
It seems like, though, I mean, there's been other attempts to change. I mean, you think about, you know, what the Corps of Engineers has done with the Mississippi River to control it,
mm-hmm.
and it ends up with all kinds of unintended consequences of losing your wetlands and whatever in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it just seems like when we try to change.
So yeah, I mean, like I say, it seems easy, but there might be unintended consequences. Ryan.
What are those tipping points? Can you define those?
Yeah, you know, I actually don't like to use the term tipping points. I pulled this out of something I was reading recently. So the main problem with it is it is ill-defined, and I think most tipping points that are out there, you don't realize you've reached them until you're already past them. But the examples I've sort of given are collapse of the whole Greenland ice sheet. And the thing about that is once that collapse of the ice sheet has already happened, you're way past the actual tipping point, which is the time where that became inevitable. And it's really hard for us to know where that tipping point is.
I've read about like positive feedback reactions. So for example, like
mm-hmm.
methane
mm-hmm.
Underneath the tundra in Siberia, mm-hmm. and that after a certain amount is released, that basically all of it will be inevitably released. Is that?
Yeah, that's a possibility. That's subject to uncertainty, but.
Well, I think what it speaks to is you talked about the doubling of CO2 raises, there's a band of temperature, right, that you would see an increase
yeah.
in temperature.
Yeah.
So if all of a sudden you release a bunch of methane from Siberia, you wouldn't double your CO2 in
mm-hmm.
70 years, it might be 10 years.
Yeah, and you know, methane is another greenhouse gas that acts at the same time as CO2, and it's a much stronger greenhouse gas. But I would say that this fits under the heading of problems with model processes. So most models probably at this point are not taking into account, at least not accurately, the process that you're talking about, the release of methane from Arctic wetlands. Brian?
If this is totally impractical, but hypothetically, if we determined as a world that we wanted to stop the increase of greenhouse gases,
mm-hmm.
what would it take to do that?
That's more a question for tomorrow.
Okay.
Nice segue. Go back tomorrow.
Write it down.
Yeah, so tomorrow is climate change mitigation, prevention of sort of the highest magnitudes of climate change. And I guess the short answer, according to James Hansen's book, Storms of My Grandchildren, which I recommended before, he says you really have to rely strongly on nuclear power generation in order to prevent the worst kinds of climate change.
That assumes that power generation is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas. Is that a foregone conclusion? I mean, do we know that?
Yeah, that's a highly established conclusion, yeah.
And vehicle emissions is also a big contributor, I assume?
Yeah, well, you know, part of the plan in that case would be to use vehicles charged by nuclear-generated power. So one way of doing that is battery-powered cars. And another that's kind of been tossed around and hasn't come to fruition is saving this, storing this energy in hydrogen. So you could actually have hydrogen-fueled vehicles. Although some infamous hydrogen vehicles were the Hindenburg and the Challenger.
What's, yeah, what's something in, or the thing that you remember most, I guess, in climate science that was thought to be understood but later misunderstood and really was able to be, I'm thinking, like, it didn't seem that way at first, but, or,
yeah, the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart is the example I gave. The incorrect assumptions about the mechanisms for changes in Great Lakes levels. And there are still people who want to doubt this. And again, Catherine Hayhoe is kind of sticking to this. And it was just last week that we had some back and forth by email for the National Climate Change Assessment on how to word these projected changes in Great Lakes levels. And there was a go-between, but Catherine Hayhoe was telling him one thing, and I and my colleagues were telling another thing, and my colleague Drew Gronewald got really hot under the collar about this.
Did he win?
We kind of got a compromise wording in there. I think we mostly got our way.
Does all of this mean that 100 years from now, people will be going to Minnesota in the wintertime where it's temperate climate?
Yeah, that's possible. One of the scenarios that was kind of brought to me by a newspaper reporter at one time that I said, yeah, that's kind of realistic, is that people will be moving from the Southwest into the Great Lakes region for the water.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I just hope they don't start building canals and tubes to go from Minnesota to the arid Southwest to give them water. Mm-hmm. I selfishly want to keep it up.
Yeah, well, okay. One of the things specific to the Great Lakes about that is the Canadians won't allow it. There are international treaties dating back to 1907, I think, that strictly govern the amount of water that can be withdrawn from the Great Lakes. And the basic rule is none of it can go outside of the Great Lakes drainage basin. There are a few things we were talking about, the Chicago diversion. So there's a treaty that governs how much water can go through the Chicago diversion. And there's a whole binational agency called the International Joint Commission that keeps a watch over how much water is being transferred and just basically also keeps tabs on what the lake levels are, how much water is being let through the water controls at the outlet of Lake Superior and Lake Ontario. Those are the two that have controls where they're where they have outlets. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.